Hello everyone, and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly news roundup podcast, where we take a critical look at a number of topical developments from the past few days with a leadership and management theme. I am Rod Jones, Content Manager at the Institute, and in this podcast we will be looking at news from the week beginning the 1st of July. Joining me to analyse these stories is Kate Cooper, Head of Research, Policy and Standards at the Institute. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Rod.
Our first story, Kate, concerns the business cost of hangovers. According to pioneering research from the Institute of Alcohol Studies, hangovers could be costing UK PLC up to £1.4 billion per year. The organisation found in its research that 42% of the 3,400 workers it surveyed had gone to work either hungover or intoxicated, and 9% had done so in the past 6 months. Higher earners emerged as more likely to have gone to work hungover or under the influence. Respondents also reported being affected during work hours by their peers' drinking habits. 36% suspected that one or more of their colleagues had been hungover or intoxicated in the workplace over the past 6 months, resulting in reduced productivity, exacerbated stress, and negative effects on team morale. Kate, how should leaders respond to this report's findings?
Well, firstly, I don't suppose they'll be at all surprised at the extent of what is being termed presenteeism, because people come to work all the time feeling under par, whether that's with a mental health issue or a physical illness, because, of course, there's an expectation to be there. Depending on sick pay policies, people go into work when they're not at their productive best. But I think alcohol is more disturbing in many ways, because we know from the health service, from police, how damaging excess consumption of alcohol can be and how expensive that can be for society. So we need to take this seriously as we take other issues. And of course, with alcohol, it's a bit different because we celebrate so many successes with occasions that involve alcohol. So it's almost like a double-edged sword here. So what I would say to leaders and managers, and of course it's the line managers who most notice these things, they notice people being different, behaving differently, being less productive, is not to ignore it, not to brush it under the carpet. Make sure that all the employee assistance channels are there, accessible, encourage people to use them, and don't ignore it. Have a word. And of course, coming into work intoxicated or hungover, that's not the funny or fun side of alcohol. That's the downside that's obviously not only impacting the individuals concerned, but their colleagues.
Thank you very much, Kate. Moving on to our second story. This story looks at, is well-being a luxury? And the report is that Goldman Sachs' 6,000-strong London-based workforce is preparing to move into its lavish new headquarters, and this is reported by the Evening Standard. According to the paper, with total floor space exceeding the dimensions of 26 football pitches, the 10-storey, £1.1 billion Plumtree Court contains an array of facilities to help top-flight finance executives grapple with the daily intensities of their professional lives. In addition to a health centre complete with GP and nursing staff, a full complement of physiotherapy, psychiatry and psychology practices, the headquarters boasts contemplation rooms, group prayer and choir practice room, resting rooms for workers, a gym, a yoga studio and steam rooms, an underground cycle park and a lactation suite for new mothers, and also a 7,000 square foot nursery and play centre for workers' children. Goldman Sachs International CEO Richard Gnaud told The Standard, "We are delighted to have built a world-class office for our people, enabling them to collaborate and serve clients in an efficient and attractive space." Kate, do buildings such as these show that well-being is becoming a luxury item that most organisations can only dream of? Or are these initiatives, or are there other initiatives that every organisation can put into place regardless of their spending power.
Well, just as there are inequalities in pay and benefits, of course there are going to be inequalities in well-being and how much employers are able or willing to invest in the well-being of their staff. It's no coincidence that these are some of the most highly paid people in the UK. And of course, expectations of them to be at the office for long hours and have to be at peak physical fitness. And so it's in the employer's interest to make sure that people are looked after. And of course, it's great for talent retention. Pleased to see that mothers are being specially considered with the lactation suites. But it doesn't mean that other employers can't take the well-being of their staff as seriously. And it's not always just about investing money. It's often about showing that you care and giving people space and time to pursue their own individual health objectives, to understand that you can't keep putting people under pressure without being able to support them, to give them breaks, to have away days, to let them do things like volunteer perhaps for a number of hours a week.
Okay, thank you, Kate. Our third story is taken from cityam.com, reporting that the FTSE 100 is to hit its board gender target by the year 2020. Figures published today show that 32.1% of FTSE 100 board positions are held by women, up from 12.5% in 2011. The number of FTSE 250 board positions held by women has also increased from 24.9% to 27.5%, according to the Hampton Alexander Review. Sir Philip Hampton, chair of the review, said the FTSE 250 is working hard to catch up, but still too many boards have only one woman, and remarkably today there are four all-male boards in the FTSE 250. Kate, is this good news? Or should organisations be doing even more to ensure gender balance on board positions?
Well, any picture where there's an improvement, and as there has been here, an increase in representation, of course, is to be celebrated. But as with the gender pay gap, it's such a crude measure that all we can say is that's great, it's gone up. We can't comment on the rate of progress because I think it's probably still too slow. And also, people are on boards to represent a function, to represent a part of the business, to bring new and different perspectives. They're not there because they happen to be a man or a woman. And I think the pressure on women, especially when they're the only, or even when there's only one or two females on a board, to lose sight of what they're there for in terms of their genuine representation and then be seen as representing gender and women's issues and bringing a female perspective, in a way, is defeating the purpose. What we want is a diverse board that happens to be diverse because senior management positions are filled with a diverse range of people. So the glass ceiling that women tend to hit, of course, is the same for ethnicity and disability. And it's those are the sorts of things that we should really be challenging. We want diversity. We don't want tokenism.
And is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Yes, Rod, last week Phil James was on BBC World News talking about the four-day week. And while for so many it seems to be a great idea, of course a shorter working week, increased leisure, Phil did sound a cautionary note.
Phil, when you heard about Rich's experiment, which is a year in, what struck you?
Well, it's a really joyful story. I think Rich and his whole team have set an example of what can be achieved when we think outside the box. You know, as employers, as leaders and managers in organisations, there are things at our disposal that we can do to make work more not only bearable, but joyful and meaningful.
So should we all be doing this?
Well, that's where I would sound a note of caution, I think, where this success story has worked in Rich's company. I can't actually see it working elsewhere. If you consider some of the different industries where a four-day working week might be more problematic, think about healthcare, think about the self-employed, the gig economy, where shorter working hours, short availability of work leads directly to less pay, then I think, you know, a direct lift and shift of a four-day working week could be problematic.
Additionally, we were so pleased to be sponsors of the Inspirational Leadership Award at the Talent in Logistics Conference. Fantastic awards dinner, well attended, and really to see how much is going on in transport and how important it is for the UK economy, certainly at the moment and absolutely going forward, whatever the Brexit outcome is. Really proud to be there.
Thank you again, Kate. That concludes this week's episode, and listeners can find further topical content in the News and Views section on the Institute's website at www.institutelm.com. And thank you once again, Kate, for your insights on these stories.
Thanks, Rod.